This is the Medicast, recorded last week for the Medicast Live on April 15th, 2010. Released today, April 19th, 2010.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the pod medic, Jamie Davis.
Good day and welcome to this episode of the Medicast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and this is another episode of the Medicast Live, recorded last Thursday. We had an opportunity to talk with two Army medic instructors from Fort Dix, New Jersey, and they were very gracious to join us and share some of the information about what kind of training the Army medics get, what their levels are and equivalents in the civilian sector, and just a little bit about the special equipment they carry, the types of techniques they use, and how that trickles down to us in trauma care. And so we'll be talking about that in just a second. I just want to remind you, you can find links to some of the information discussed in this show over at medicast.com/blog. There's a show notes link right at the top of the page. Just click that. You can also sign up for our newsletter, and you'll find that also on the front page right there. Just go ahead and fill that out, just your name and email address, and we'll get the show notes sent to you every single week. Remind you, there's a show available. And of course, you can always subscribe via iTunes, Zune Marketplace, and any other podcatcher that you'd like to use for your MP3 player. All available for free, but just great ways to make sure you don't miss an episode of the Medicast. If you have any comments on this very special episode, definitely get those into me here. You can mail those in by email to podmedic@mac.com or call in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342. 941-30-MEDIC is the way you catch up with me here on the show. So we'll jump right on into that interview and Medicast Live episode recorded earlier this week in just a bit. This is the Medicast Live, April 15th, 2010. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we are here today to have our monthly call for the Medicast Live, where we get to bring people in and ask them questions. And this month, I'm really honored to have in two Army medic instructors from Fort Dix who are going to be sharing with me and with you some of the thoughts about how Army medic training progresses, combat medicine, and how combat medicine has affected the care of trauma here in the United States. We've seen anybody who's been taking any kind of trauma classes, PHTLS or anything like that, have seen some of the protocols adjust based on lessons learned dealing with multi-system trauma in the armed services serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so we can take those lessons and use them to help our patients here at home. But what are they learning and how does that process work? And what kind of training goes into becoming an Army medic? And so we're going to be asking those questions. On the show tonight, we have Sergeant Maharis and also Sergeant Clemens. I'll start with Sergeant Maharis. Leo is your name. And just tell us a little bit about how long you've been an Army medic and a little bit about your background.
Thanks, Jamie. Jamie, I've been an Army medic for roughly 11 years. I joined back in 1998. Never in my wildest dream did I ever think I was going to go to war. I've been to two deployments to Iraq. One in 2003 when the war first started, and another one in 2005. Other than that, on my civilian sector, I'm also a National Registered Paramedic and also a critical care paramedic doing everyday 911 calls.
Excellent. And Sergeant Clemens, Henry, you're also an Army medic instructor. Tell us a little bit about you, how long you've been in the military and an Army medic and what your background is.
Well, I used to be in combat arms about 20 years ago, and when I got off of active duty and went into the National Guard, they didn't have my job specialty, and they asked me what I wanted to do, and I always wanted to be a medic because the medic was the coolest guy in the whole platoon. He seemed to always know what was going on, and everybody, they treated him great, and I just liked the idea of helping the soldiers. So I went to medic school in 1991. and completed in 92. I deployed to Iraq also in 2004 and 2005 and got back and have been instructing at Fort Dix since 2006. On the civilian side, I'm also a paramedic and a critical care paramedic, and I used to work in New York City as my full-time civilian job as a paramedic.
In this ongoing conflict, we've seen some changes in the way we handle things here at home. And because you all, you, both of you are involved in the civilian sector as well, I'm sure you've seen that change. You know, I, when I first became a paramedic, tourniquets were on the way out. And they've come bounding back because of, you know, hard lessons learned in the field that we're able to preserve life and in many cases preserve limbs because we are using tourniquets appropriately in the field. And that was a lesson learned by the military. Had use of tourniquets changed in the military? And that's just the primary thing I think of. There are also the clotting agents and other things. But were tourniquets going out of style in the military, or had they always been in place?
They'd always been there, but when I first started learning the medical stuff in the military, the tourniquet was still the last resort when I initially came in. And it's only been through the lessons learned through the current conflicts that the tourniquet became a first resort thing. And I think that's more a result of better training in the field and a better understanding of how it really works. And I think that's how it's evolved that way. Leo, what do you have on that?
Pretty much the same thing, Hank. You know, Jamie, when I first got deployed to Iraq, and I remember going to training at Fort Dix, we had this one instructor. He always made me laugh because he would say, the tourniquet is the devil. You know, trying to emphasize that the tourniquet is the last resort. You know, in medicine evolves. You know, unfortunately, conflict is conflict, but medicine evolves from conflict. And we've learned, like you said before, we've learned that tourniquets are the one things that are saving our soldiers' lives in the battlefield. Because we've also found out with all the injuries that we're sustaining, our soldiers are bleeding out. So tourniquet's a great key to stop that bleeding, to try to sustain life to get them to the hospital.
Now, that's just one example of some of the things that are going on out there and how you've taken those lessons and learned them and apply them. Tell us a little bit about the training that the U.S. soldier gets in handling first aid. I know there's a combat lifesaver qualification that is maybe equivalent or similar to what we might think of as a first responder. Can you explain a little bit about the process of training and the different levels of training that are available in the Army?
Okay, well, the combat lifesaver originally was meant as a supplement to the combat medic in the field. It was not, everybody wasn't trained at it, and usually there would be, correct me if I'm wrong, Leo, it would be one soldier in 10 or one soldier in 15 would get trained as a combat lifesaver and kind of act as an assist to the medic. And a combat lifesaver can insert different types of airways. They're trained in doing tourniquets, trained in doing needle decompressions, more advanced use of the tourniquet, I should say, than what used to be taught. And it goes in and out of protocol that sometimes they're allowed to start IVs, other times they're not. Right now we're in a swing where they're not doing the IVs at the combat lifesaver level. But the biggest change in the combat lifesaver is that now every single soldier in the military is coming out of basic training as a combat lifesaver, and every current soldier in the military is being retroactively trained as a combat lifesaver. And that's kind of Leo's specialty, so I don't want to jump too much into the CLS. He's probably trained thousands of soldiers since he started doing the CLS stuff, and that's not even an underestimate. Literally thousands he's taught the CLS on, so he might be able to better talk about the evolution of that.
Go ahead, Leo.
You know, the combat lifesaver, you know, Hank talked about it a little bit. The combat lifesaver, one out of every squad had a combat lifesaver. Now more people are becoming combat lifesavers. They've noticed one thing, another thing, other than the tourniquet and this conflict. If you look how many medics we have compared to other soldiers, we're very little. A medic can't be there at all times. You know, so a lot of these patrols that go out may have a combat lifesaver. Some may be fortunate enough to have a medic, but the majority of them don't. So they noticed we need to have some sort of advanced first aid or first responder training for our soldiers. Why? Because we don't have enough medics to go around. We don't have enough medics to be on convoys. We don't have enough medics to be out there on patrol. So we started training harder on the combat lightsaber. You know, for me, one of the things that I was doing as a civilian, also as a I was also a contractor for the Air Force teaching combat lightsabers. And you could see the enthusiasm the students had when they found out what they're learning. You know, everybody hears about combat lightsabers, oh, and they're worried about the IVs and everything. But we try to teach them the core of stopping the bleeding, maintaining the open airway, and stopping that sucking chest wound, you know, which are the three most preventable deaths in the battlefield that we have right now. You know, so your combat lightsaber has really evolved, just like the medic training that we're given today.
They were asking, corresponding it to first responder, but I think you're really, there's not a lot of medical training. It's really focused on trauma care.
It is pretty much focused on just those three things that Leo mentioned, you know, maintaining the airway, stopping the sucking chest wound, you know, preventing a pneumothorax for the medical people. They know what that means. And stopping bleeding from extremity wounds. Those are the things that the three most preventable causes of death on the battlefield, as Leo said. But no, are they trained in the physiology of what they're doing? Not really so much, except for the very basics. Are they learning why they're doing what they're doing? No, it's more of a technical approach to those preventable causes of death to get them to a medic. And then what's the medic's purpose? Is to get them stabilized to get to that definitive care, which is the surgeons and the doctors back at a field hospital. So the COS has become one of the key link, the first link, I should say, in the chain of care on the battlefield. So no, they're not really trained in the knowledge end of it so much as they are in the technical end of it.
But they've really had a significant impact by increasing the numbers of combat lifesavers. They've really, based on things I've read and Tom Middleton's book talks about the effects of, you know, having that person already stabilizing or starting care by the time the medic gets there.
Huge, huge. It's had a tremendous, combining that with the education of the three leading causes of death on the battlefield, and combining that with making everybody a CLS, yeah, I think it's probably, medically speaking and life-saving speaking, probably the single most effective change that we've made since the conflicts have started. That's just that's my opinion, but from getting a lot of feedback, that's the impression that I get.
I think it can never hurt to have more trained people, first aid trained people around, you know, in a difficult situation. So I would imagine that could only make it better. And so you have the combat lifesaver that really, for our purposes, we would call as that first aid trained basic training to handle immediate care, life threats, but not really treat anything beyond just maintaining somebody while we get the medic who comes in next. Tell us a little bit how that steps up. I think that pertains kind of to an EMTB level training in its basic point. Is that correct?
Yeah, you said it right. You know, the Army medic is an EMT basic plus. We get the basic EMT foundation training, you know, that everybody goes through in the civilian world. Then we get the plus. This is where we get to give better care. When the combat lightsabers, you know, they stabilize the patient, then comes the medic and stabilizes it further, or needs to make some decisions whether to, you know, start an IV to bring up the blood pressure, or whether to change that tourniquet to a pressure dressing with one of the other hemostatic agents. That's where the medic comes along in this whole process. They get more of the pathophys, they get more of the physiology of what they're doing and why they're doing each intervention. So it's like a stair step. You need to start low, and to get them to that definitive care, you know, sometimes it goes straight from the combat lightsaber to the hospital. But sometimes we can get them from the combat lightsaber to the medic to the hospital. But either way, how we get them to the hospital, the key is to get them to the hospital. Because what we're doing as a combat lightsaber and as a medic, we're sustaining their life so the surgeons and the doctors can fix whatever they have wrong.
Now, that goes back to the early days of that theory of the golden hour, which came out of learning from Korea and from Vietnam to really think about getting that person to definitive care in under that hour time frame. And that's what we use for our current trauma care here in the civilian sector. And certainly, you know, that's something, that's a lesson that came out of combat medicine. And you all have seemed to apply that very well. Now, think about helicopter transport, but because of the ability to have forward hospital stations, you know, often that transport is by ground because you have a forward aid station with a surgeon available close to your position in many cases as well. Is that correct?
In most cases, you've got some level of definitive care within a short time frame. But in many cases, once you're away from the major cities, particularly in Iraq, once you get out of the Baghdad area or Tikrit or the bigger cities, Mosul, when you're out on the other FOBs, the smaller forward operating bases, you don't have that level of definitive care right there. So, yeah, you do still need rely heavily on that medevac or that ground transport. So it's there. And, you know, your flight medics and your flight teams are a whole different level of training. You know, they took all the basic medical stuff. Then they go through the flight physiology courses and a few other things, which is basically learning how to take care of people in the changing altitudes and different types of things like that. So it's still relied on a great deal. But in the modern battlefield, your vehicle transports are a lot faster and effective than they were in the past also. So it's kind of, we're seeing a meeting of the two. Just like with the MOS, excuse me, with the medic job in general, the civilian side and the military side for many years developed on a parallel course. It's only recently that they started to intersect. And to follow up on something that Leah was saying, that Leo is nationally registered as a paramedic. I'm New York State as a paramedic, nationally registered only as a EMT basic through the Army. But the National Registry is coming out with an EMTM certification sometime at the end of this year, which is an EMT military, which is going to be somewhere between the EMTI and the EMTP. So a lot of people I've been talking to about that, students are pretty excited about it because it's actually going to give the military people a home in the civilian world as well.
And Jamie, I also wanted to add a little bit on the whole medevac and ground transport. One of the things that have really changed, you know, if in Iraq, and I'm talking specifically in Iraq because that's where I've done my both deployments, in Iraq, when the war started, and even, you know, a few years after that, we did not have a dedicated ground transport ambulance, so to speak. You know, I know the MRAPs are coming out as ambulances. Some other vehicles coming out as ambulances. But we've never had a real dedicated ground transport. You know, we relied upon the medevac to come down, take the injured away. But the bird doesn't fly all the time. If it's sandy, you know, so, and I know they take their risk. Dust storms, they don't fly. So what we're teaching, not only our CLS, but our medics, we can use any vehicle as an evacuation platform. You know, we used to call it CASVAC. Now we call it tactical evacuation care, where we use any vehicle available to get them either to a forward surgical team or get them to the cache as soon as possible. Because you know what? We may not have the luxury to have that bird overhead to take our patients away.
We're seeing that we need to not rely on helicopter transport here in the States as well. So, you know, you still have to be able to get that person in to definitive care some way, somehow. And that's important. I just wanted to mention, I keep forgetting, but we have Mark Glencourse on the call here as well. Mark is a paramedic and RN from the UK. He's one of the stars of the Chronicles of EMS program. And Mark, just briefly, just welcome to the show. Sorry, we had trouble getting you connected, but I think we got you on here.
Yeah, hello.
So jump in if you have any questions you'd like to ask Leo or Hank about what they're talking about. Because I know this is something that is very interesting to many of us in the civilian sector. We know it's not something we see, the type of multi-system trauma, that we're not likely to see that kind of thing in the field.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I'm just sitting here and listening, fascinated to the guys talk. As you say, I was actually, I was in the what's called the 202 Field Hospital. It's a Territorial Army unit in the UK a number of years back as a nurse. So I had a little bit of insight into what goes on, but I never was deployed, thankfully. And I just have the utmost respect for these guys, and it's fascinating to hear about it and their experiences from chaps who are actually doing it. You know, I'm just sitting back here learning, just as I'm listening.
Well, great. It's good to have you on the show, Mark. One quick question came up in the chat room. Looking at the National Association of EMTs created a new trauma class just for combat medic.
Well, NAEMT has their PHTLS, which is pre-hospital trauma life support. That's given, I've seen that given to not only military, but to civilians. What they're talking about, that little small portion on the military edition book toward the end, they talk about TC3 or TCCC, however you want to call it, which is tactical combat casualty care. That is the foundation of the current, and when it was first implemented a few years ago, of not only the medical training, but also the combat lifesaver training. That course is pretty much specifically for military, but I've noticed some of the police departments around there, some of the CERT teams, SWAT teams, have taken some of the stuff that are in there and incorporated it into their training. The NAEMT came out with... They've always had PHTLS, but the military needed that TCCC side of it into a book. So NAEMT came over and said, you know, we're going to publish this in our book and call it the Pre-Hospital Trauma Life Support Military Edition, where it has that little portion of TCCC or TC3. Hank, do you want to add something on that?
Actually, yeah. Just to follow up on what you were saying with the civilian side, as I said, I used to work as a paramedic in New York City. I am now a police officer, and every member of my police department is trained in the law enforcement end of that TC3. And our trauma kits that go on our hips all consist of exactly what we carry in the first aid kit for the Army now. So there is a big crossover, if that's what you were getting at, whether civilians can train in that or not, Janie. Yes, they are currently doing that.
Excellent. There was a question asked earlier in the chat room about how long it takes to go through some of this training. So, for instance, I think it was Leo that does the combat lifesaver training. How long is the combat lifesaver course for a soldier that wants to take that class?
The combat lifesaver course, you know, goes for any soldier, airman, seaman, everybody. It's 40 hours. The portion allotted is 40 hours. It also depends on how many students we have. We could do it a little bit less, a little bit more, but it's roughly 40 hours of not only classroom time, hands-on, and we like to incorporate down at Fort Dix simulation training. So it could take, if we do 10-hour days, 4 days. If we do 8-hour days, 5 days. So we usually try to keep it like around 4 days, so that way the students, one, don't get waterlogged with all the information, and two, they're able to absorb the information that we're trying to give them.
And then beyond that, the next level of training, the combat medic, what does that entail as far as how long does that course run?
Well, that's months. What you do in your medical training after your 8 to 10 weeks of basic training, depending on you know what cycle the Army is using at that point, you'll go to Fort Sam Houston in Texas. And you take an EMTB course. And for the people out there who are EMTB's National Registry, it's exactly that. You take the full 110-hour EMTB course, complete with hospital rotations and everything else. In addition to that, you will do all the military stuff that Leo was talking about before, the TC3, and on top of that, you go out into the field for a number of days to do your field and tactical training. So all added up, that comes out to, I believe, and Leo, please correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it comes out to 14 weeks straight.
Yeah, I think that's right.
After basic training. And then you get certified not only as an Army medic, but also as a nationally registered EMTB. The two go hand in hand now.
Take a quick break. Remind you, we are speaking with Sergeants Leo Maharis and Hank Clemens from Fort Dix, U.S. Army Medic Training Center in New Jersey, talking about the Army Medic program, and we'll be adding more to that, including a great question coming in from our good friend Mark Glencourse, who's also on the call from the MedicCast Live we recorded last Thursday. You'll hear that coming right up. So here's Mark Glencourse with his question about civilian applications for the military training and their mission.
Could I ask a quick question? If you've covered this before, I apologize, but what is the highest level that you can actually get to in the service? And also, I know the Army Medics over in the UK, they are developed in ways such as primary care and healthcare screening and stuff for when they're actually not deployed or at war. Is the same sort of thing with you guys over there? Can you actually get to an advanced practitioner level at some point, or is it just purely the MT?
Yes, there. When you start getting into more of the specialized units, like a special operations or the Ranger medic, they get certified as an advanced tactical provider, which is a higher level as the Army medic. The 18 Delta Course, and Hank, you correct me if I'm wrong, the 18 Delta Course, which is the medical sergeant, the special operations medical sergeant course, brings them up to ATP or advanced tactical provider plus. And I know there's and I know, and I'm still learning some of the stuff too. The Ranger medic is we have identifiers after our MOS is, like, for me, example, I'm a 68 whiskey, and then we have like 68 whiskey ones, which are Ranger medics, and then we have 18 deltas, which are special operations medical sergeants. So there is a more advanced level to the military medicine training that we do currently have. Hank?
Is that all trauma related, though? Is there any training for peacetime duties or?
The special forces medics, they're actually trained to do field surgery on top of other things. They actually do surgery in the field. They're also trained, your special operations soldiers, those medics are trained to the paramedic level and above. So, yes, they are advanced clinicians, and they do get all the corresponding anatomy and physiology and cardiology and all the advanced medical treatments that you would see at the paramedic level, and then a little bit higher than that. Are they certified at anything higher than paramedic? No, not really, not in the civilian world. So unless I'm misinterpreting your question, Mark, as enlisted, we can only go that far. If you want to become a nurse or more, you would have to be, well, a registered nurse, you would have to get a commission and become an officer. You can, as a medic, go through the licensed practical nurse course, which is much more clinically in-depth.
Uh-huh. Oh, thank you.
I hope that helped.
No, very much so. I was just curious how the role develops, if it does all just constantly go down trauma care. But obviously when you're not at war, when you're not deployed, then if there was a function for that same level of medic in your own unit or on base and things like that.
No, it's the same regardless, whether we're at war or deployed, I should say, or whether we're within the States, our level of training is the same. The only difference is prior to going on a deployment, all medics in whichever unit is deploying will get separated and go through what they call a ramp up, where they'll get reinforcement training on all the things that they should be proficient in and just get them back into the swing of things to make sure that they're still proficient.
And one other thing I wanted to point out, Mark, is, like, for an example, 18 Delta or Special Operations Medic, they get the paramedic level training. They get, they do a little bit of dentistry, things with the eyes. They do a little bit of field surgery. In the military, that's great. They could do that. But the moment they come to the civilian world, strictly out of the military, if they're certified as a paramedic, because I have heard back in the day that some special operations medic weren't certified as a paramedic. If they are certified as a paramedic, they can only do the scope of practice of a paramedic, even though they're trained on, minor dentistry, and minor surgery. So they always have to fall back in the civilian world to their scope of practice at whatever certification level they're at.
One of the things that I, when I was reading Tom Middleton's book, looking at his tour in Ramadi as a medic with the New Hampshire National Guard, he discussed the fact that he was looking at how the role of the combat medic had changed over the years. He discussed some of that, you know, from the time when the combat medic was unarmed. In past wars and conflicts, they wore brightly colored patches or armbands that portrayed them as a medic. But over the years, that went away as the rules of war were no longer honored and the Geneva Convention was no longer honored. And they became more of a combat soldier along with being a medic. You know, in fact, he became really part of the squad and platoon in which he was operating. Is that something that, you know, that's something you train along with them? They have to be a combat soldier as well and carry the whole kit plus their medical bag?
Yes, absolutely. Everybody has to be a soldier first. And you're right, that went back. The last time medics were unarmed was during World War II and the very beginning of Korea. Unfortunately, some of our country's adversaries in the past would target medics because, well, not to brag, but we're valuable. We can only do certain things, and without us, plus our other soldiers go to great lengths to try and help the medics. And they realize that by targeting medics, they can cut down a lot of the unit's effectiveness from a distance. So, yes, we did have to become armed. First, we were only armed with pistols, and that was fine for a time. But nowadays, depending on the type of unit you're in, and I can only speak from my experience in Iraq, in my unit, all the medics carried rifles. In addition to all of our regular gear plus our medic bag, we carried rifles because of the nature of our mission. Other times, they will still carry only a pistol depending on where they are. And it's basically a matter of self-defense, but as far as integrating within to the squads or within to the units you're in, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, we still have that special status, and we still get lectured as part of our mobilization times as to certain things that we do or don't do can violate our protected status under the Geneva Convention, because theoretically we still are protected under the Geneva Convention. Granted, in low-intensity conflicts and actions other than war, which is what we're involved in now, the Geneva Convention does not always, unfortunately, apply, but we still adhere to it on our side within, you know, every possible amount of reasonability, but we still have to get lectured as to what we can and can't do as far as our status goes. Now, that was my experience in Iraq, and what I had to do was with the rifle and with a larger unit. And Leo, I'm not sure how it worked out for you. So what was your weaponry?
When I was deployed in 2003, my weaponry was the M16. That's what I carried around. We only had one medical sergeant that carried the 9mm. And the biggest reason, like Hank talked about, the Geneva Conventions, you know, we are a defensive weapon, so to speak. You know, and I know I've heard stories, you know, that some medics, some medics go out there and they're, you know, with the offensive group. Okay, we're soldiers first. But like you say, we're also told things that we can and cannot do. Why? Because we do honor the Geneva Convention, you know, for an example. It's all unit-specific also, you know, because if you're in an infantry unit where you're very limited on your personnel and you need everybody to, for example, know how to man an M2 50 cal machine gun, everybody should learn how to do that, including the medic. You know, and when the poopy hits the fan, you know, you better hope that medic knows how to get up there and, you know, be that defensive weapon so your fellow soldiers don't get hit anymore. You know, we learn all that, but we do go by the Geneva Conventions. We do carry, you know, unit-specific weaponry. You know, for my example, 2003, the M16. When I went back in 2005, same thing, 16.
And what kind of equipment does a combat medic carry? And I mean, they're carrying their full combat load of equipment and weaponry, ammunition, and then they've got to have an on top of all of that equipment and material, they've got to have an additional bag. What do they carry? I mean, how do you prepare for a combat injury, and how much can you physically carry to treat, you know, one or more soldiers before you've just got too much in your kit?
I tell you one thing, Jamie. I kind of learned that the hard way when I got deployed both times. We carry the same load as every other soldier. you know, our ballistic vests, our plates, our full capacity of ammunition, you know, and yes, and we carry our medic bag, you know. So, and for me specifically, I tried having two different bags, one for trauma, one for medical, because as a medic, you know, I'm trained, yes, on trauma, but I'm also trained on everyday sick call for our soldiers. So I would try to have two different bags, and depending on what type of mission I would go on, that's the type of bag that I would take. But inside the bag, we, you know, when you talk about trauma, we try to have everything that we can to include, you know, IV bags, you know, the angiocath, the hemostatic agents, as much as we can. Now, we've gotten smarter. You know, we've gotten smarter. For example, IV bags, we, like what I would do, I would give IV bags to different people so I wouldn't have to carry. If I could have 10 soldiers carry, you know, one 500cc bag of Hexten, and that's 10, you know, 10 bags out there, that's 10 bags that I don't have to carry. So we did work a little bit smarter, but yeah, we carry everything everybody else carries, plus our bags.
What about you, Hank? Do you have any particular, you know, was there something that you always made sure you had with you in addition to your standard load? Or?
Yeah, it's actually, I was just laughing, though, because apparently we all go through the same learning curve, because I tried to pack two separate bags, too, and realized early on that it was not going to work out. And then I did disperse extra equipment among my soldiers because, like you said, you know, a 1 liter bag or a half a liter bag of fluid on a soldier, they're not even going to notice it. But if I'm trying to carry 10, but with me, yeah, I used to like to carry, I could not get enough extra tourniquets and the specific Israeli dressings and things like that. And, you know, and quick clot. Those are my three big ones. Stop the bleeding, stop the bleeding, stop the bleeding. You know, because the odds, I always looked at it as this, you know, from our primary injuries that we suffered, especially where I was more from incoming indirect fire, like mortar rounds and rockets and things like that. My unit was not on a terribly large amount of convoys, but we took a lot of indirect fire on a daily basis. So I always wanted to be ready for those blast-type injuries, the bleeding stuff, as opposed to the airway, because the odds of the airway happening were slightly less, and you don't need as much to fix it. So, yeah, if you're asking me what would I like to carry more, anything in relating to hemorrhage control would probably be where I would lean stuff more.
And I heard Hexten, so your fluid replacement of choice is not something like lactated ringers or normal saline.
Well, the Hexten is lighter because you get six times the amount of productivity out of it. A half a liter of Hexten is going to give you the same value fluid replacement as three full liters of lactated ringers or normal saline. So just on the basis of weight, the Hexten is better. And from the patient standpoint, from the injured soldier standpoint, you're going to retain a lot more of that Hexten in the cells and the fluids than you would with the other ones, because they leach out into the interstitial spaces. You get a lot of third space loss from those. So, yeah, the Hexten is the fluid of choice when possible.
And the key point there is we only use Hexten for somebody that's lost a lot of blood from examination. You know, we don't use the Hexten for somebody that's dehydrated. We don't use Hexten because somebody drank too much the night before. Specifically used for that loss of blood, and we're just trying to bring up that pressure again.
Now, do you carry any other anything else that's a medication? You know, you said you had two different bags. Do you carry any other medications other than IV fluids in your other bag?
And different units have different SOPs, standard operating procedures. Some units, you know, when in 2003, I didn't get a whole lot. You know, I was. Let me tell you, before I got deployed, I was a chef. So I get deployed to Iraq, and I have to learn all the stuff, I mean, quick. My second deployment, I got a little bit more medications because I had a little bit better knowledge of what I was going to do with it. Unit-specific or mission-specific, you would get more stuff. Like, you could get IV fluids. We got that. Normal saline, lactated ringers, or Hexten. Analgesics like morphine, some people would get that, and also have to be, you know, approved by a PA or a doctor. Fentanyl pops or fentanyl lollipops for pain control, same thing. You know what I mean? It also depends on the unit and what doctor's signing you off saying that you know how to use that. So, yeah, some of the medics would actually get some analgesics, and also depending on what type of mission they're going on.
What about morphine, pain management in the field? Do you have morphine auto-injectors, or I would assume it wouldn't be expedient to have to draw up morphine?
Well, from my experience, I would have the Versajets, the pre-filled little syringes where I have to connect the plunger, or not the plunger, but the pusher to it, you know, with the needle on the other end. Now, I did hear of some medics getting auto-injector morphines, but I personally haven't seen them. Hank, can you add on?
No, I didn't have the auto-injectors either. I had the same thing, the Versajets, where you had the dose in there, you knew what it was, and you threw the needle on the one end and the plunger on the other. It was fast enough. It was fast enough, not as fast as an auto-injector, but I think at the time when we were there, they weren't commonplace yet. I believe that there's a lot more of them out there now, and as far as me with medications, since I was already a paramedic when I deployed, I had a good relationship with my doctors and PAs. So basically, if I could beg, borrow, or steal it, my doctors would let me carry it. And we did a lot of work with civilians, so we dealt with diabetics, we dealt with cardiac patients. I carried a little bit of everything in there, whatever I could grab a hold of.
When you're going through the training with putting the training together for whether it's combat lifesaver or combat medic, how do you get that training across to them? I mean, you're going to be dealing with horrific injuries and not something that, you know, your standard mannequin can deal with as far as making it look real. How do you prepare them? Do you use any kind of the simulation aids, or what kind of physical skills training do they go through?
Well, you would be surprised what our mannequins can do. Our mannequins breathe, scream, blink, bleed, have a pulse, you name it, they do it. And Leo can tell you a little bit more about our trauma room, where we take them as far as realism and how that goes. Why don't you tell them a little about our back room there, Leo?
Sure. You know, we have at the Mystic, we call it, the Medical Simulation Training Center at Fort Dix. We try to have the most realistic training next to having, you know, live tissue. The most realistic training that we can get, you know, for the money. You know, we have these mannequins where, like Hank said, they breathe, they blink, they yell, you know, but they sound like Leo and Hank for some reason. They have pulses. We try to immerse them in actually feeling the breath coming out of the mouth. Actually feeling that wound, you know, feeling the wetness, feeling the warmth, whatever we could do to try to make it as realistic as possible. Because I remember when I first saw my first wound, let me tell you, it wasn't a pretty sight. You know, now I see a wound, you know, I'm not going to say that it doesn't bother me a little bit, but I'm more prepared. Why? Because I've seen it before. So we try a combination of a couple things. We try to wean them into the medical simulation portion of it. Like for me, for an example, I love using pictures. You know, I love using pictures. You know, some people, and I tell them in the beginning of the class, if anybody here feels like, and I tell them, I have graphic pictures. If anybody here feels like they have to leave, please leave and then come back so I could go back to the picture. Why? Because if you can get desensitized from looking at the picture, that just takes you one step closer to being desensitized when you see it in real life. You know, would I love to, you know, have, you know, real live tissue? Yeah, I would love to. There's limitations to that, you know, and there's also laws about that. But we try to get them as close as possible to the real, real thing.
And you're really training the way you're going to fight, you know, being prepared and working hard to work with as realistic a condition as possible so that when the time comes, they're really prepared as possible. Kind of the medic version of live fire training.
They train in the dark. They train with fog. They train with gunfire noises. And I'm not saying, you know, like it's over a little computer speaker. We have an entire sound system that basically you can hear from half a mile away. Explosions, gunfire. We put civilians on the battlefield utilizing other instructors and volunteers. We put enemy combatants on the battlefield. We have trenches and houses that they have to clear, barbed wire they got to crawl under, walls they got to climb over, and the last room is completely in the dark with fog and strobe lights and everything else, and it's very intense. And we have had some soldiers who have actually had either completed it or could not complete it and just needed to sit down and say, wow, that was really intense. And that's what we're going for. We're not trying to scare anybody. We're not trying to hurt anybody. But like Leo said, we're trying to get as realistic as possible now to lessen the potential shock later on if, God forbid, it happens to them on a deployment. Because you're never going to know how you're going to react till it happens for real. All we can do is try and provide the best preparation possible before it happens.
So you get this skills training, and I'll start with Leo here, but you must also deal with the fact that they have to be prepared for, you know, losing a patient and talking about that trauma to them that they will feel if they have tried to treat somebody, and this is probably someone they know. It's not just like you're on an EMS call and you roll up on a motor vehicle accident and you got a dead patient there. You don't know them from anyone else. It upsets you, but it's not upsetting as it's the guy that shares a tent with you every day. Do you prepare? Do you do any special extra training to talk to them about that and deal with post-traumatic stress and those other issues?
You know, in my lectures, I like to use a lot of my personal experience, what I felt like, you know, the times that I felt like I had to go to the bathroom when stuff was going on. I try using my personal experience to help them with what they may see. Losing the life of a buddy, you know, you can't put a slide on there and say, you know, you're going to lose the life of your buddy. This is how you have to act. You know, you really have to, the instructor really has to, if they've been through that, good. If they haven't been through that, talk to people that have been through it to see how they dealt with it and relay that information to your students. Because you're right, they're going to be getting deployed with their friends. They're going to be getting deployed with their fellow soldiers, with their fellow Marines. When it happens to them and one of their buddies, they have to be able to work through that shock. One of the ways that we help them through that is with the realistic training. But you're right, I personally try talking to them, you know, and sometimes when I see a slide, you know, I get a flashback, you know, and this is what I felt. But I try talking to them to try to guide them working through that shock. Because I remember my first wound that I saw, I was like, I froze, you know, and I didn't have that realistic training that they have now. I didn't have that mentor instructor that would tell me, you know, this is what you're going to see. You have to put that aside and get down there and help your buddy out. So I personally try talking to them on certain slides to try to coach them into, you know, if this happens and it's your buddy, you really have to work through that, you know, and help them out.
Hank?
I have to agree. I mean, it's very difficult to stand up there in front of a group of people. Now, we do a lot of EMT refreshers here as well. And a lot of our students that come through, because they have to recert every 2 years to maintain their national registry. So you look at a classroom of 40 people, and sometimes it's 50-50. 50 have been deployed, 50% have been deployed, 50% haven't. And I find myself up there trying to explain something theoretically that it could quite possibly be the most traumatic thing that they deal with. The way I deal with it when I'm teaching is I try and highlight more of how to deal with it when it happens. In other words, how to take care of the people who are still here. Because how an individual deals with the death of a friend or a comrade, it's a very personal and intimate thing, and I can't speak to that to each individual that's looking at me. And I think it's also too important for me to try and generalize it. Like Leo was saying, when he speaks of it, his own personal experiences bubble up to the surface. It's a very intimate thing. My experiences come to the surface when I start to talk about that. So I really try and focus on with the group, get the group dynamic and say, hey, you know, you're going to lose somebody at some point. If you do, you have to learn how to take care of each other. And this is what you need to look out for. And this is how you need to be there for each other. And these are the resources that are available to you. That's normally how I approach it.
I appreciate that. And that's a difficult question. And I just wanted to bring that out because I think it's just a unique situation where you're working and living with your prospective patients from day to day. It makes it just very challenging.
It's particularly different being the medic as opposed to being the CLS. Like we said earlier, everybody's becoming a CLS. And it's great because the soldiers feel empowered to help their buddies now. And realistically, they are. But when you're the medic and you've been with a group of soldiers for a long time, they look up to you and they learn to rely on you and they learn, and you want every single one of them to come home. And you feel that every injury, that every sickness, that every headache, and unfortunately every death, it weighs heavily on you as the medic, because even if you're not there, you're always going to feel like there was something you could have done to prevent it.
That is true. That is really
right.
True.
And it's not just a physical thing. As a medic, you become like a, God, I hate using the term, but one of the things that I did more often than many other things was I worked with the chaplain. I was like, you know, a go-to guy for emotional issues or homesick issues or things like that. And I was like a go-between to get people to see the chaplain. I mean, it's a big role as a medic, and you feel that every little thing that goes wrong is your fault. You know, and even when something goes right, you feel like you could have done it better.
And I also want to add something, Jamie, you know, a personal story of mine. You know, I don't know if you remember a little while back, you know, when I first got deployed, I was a chef. You know, man, I could cook some good food. I get activated. I go to Fort Dix for training. I get deployed as a medic. You know, and I've been a medic, EMT basic, since 98. But I really didn't work as an EMT basic for all those years. I got deployed. Let me tell you, I learned a lot. You know, I've seen a lot. I learned a lot. You know, but there was always something in the back of my mind saying, you know, I need to know more. When it comes to trauma, when it comes to medicine, I need to know more. 2003, 2004, I was an EMT basic. I came back home, you know, and this whole thing in Fallujah started happening, and I kept on saying to myself, I need to go back to school. I need to go back to school and get a higher certification. And once I get the higher certification, I want to go back. I want to go back to Iraq because I want to help people out. I'm going to know more. And that's what I did. I came back to school. I found the quickest accelerated paramedic course that I could find, did it, finished it. 6 months later, I'm going back to Iraq. You know, and when I get over there, yeah, I knew more. Yeah, I could save. Oh, man, I know how to treat people with heart attacks. I know how to do this. I could do that. You know what? And I found myself being good as a patient care provider, being really good. But I also found myself that I was evenly good or equally good as an instructor, where I could go and teach, you know, from my experience and teach what I know. You know, and I guess I found my niche. In 2005, I did a lot of patient care, but I also did a lot of training, you know, to everybody. And that's where I started doing a lot of the combat lifesaver training. And when I came back, I continued with that. Continued working at the Mystic at Fort Dix. Continued working as a contractor. You know what, even today, I'm continuing doing that on the civilian sector, teaching all these medical trainings. Why? Because I feel that I have a lot of information to give. I feel that I want to pass on, you know, some of my knowledge to everybody. You know, because I remember what it was like not having that in the beginning.
Well, I think you've done a great job. I mean, it's been a very informative session. We're rolling towards the end of the hour. I've got a couple of quick questions from the chat room as we wrap up here. First one is, and I guess I'll just throw this out to Leo first for the first question. Marines, they can become combat lifesavers, but do they still have Navy corpsmen as their primary combat medics?
They do. I've done some training with the Marines, and they have combat lifesavers just like everybody else. their IFAC, or their individual first aid kits, is a little bit different than the Army's and a little bit different than the Air Force's. But yeah, they're combat lightsabers. They go through the same training. Some Marine units do the combat lightsaber and also do an additional training like live tissue training. Now, they do have corpsmen, and just like in the Army, you know, there's not enough corpsmen to go around, and sometimes some of the other branches get injected into a Marine unit to substitute that corpsman. Like, I got a personal friend of mine that in 2003, he's an Army medic. He was attached to a Marine unit as their medic or as their corpsman. So, yeah, they do have Navy corpsmen, you know, that take tactical training that do get deployed with Marine units.
Okay. So let's move on to the next one. Intubation. Is that something that is taught as well to manage that airway in a definitive manner to drop that ET tube or some other airway management device?
No. We use the combi tube is the standard airway that we train on, which is not as good as an ET tube, as you know, but it's relatively effective. Now, can Leo do an ET tube? Yes, he can. Can I? Yes, I can, because we're certified at the level where we're trained to do it. It's not taught standard to the regular regularly certified Army medic, but they can use the combi tube, and when used properly, it's almost as effective. And then the combat lifesavers, their only advanced airway management that they'll use is a nasopharyngeal airway, and they're basically just trying to keep whatever they have open. So ET tubes are fairly rare out there.
So you would have to really talk to your combat hospital to get a supply of them if you were qualified, but the combi tubes are really the airway of choice.
Right. I mean, realistically, I mean, if you've ever done an ET tube, you I'm sure you have, right, Jamie? Or
yes, yep. Yes.
Okay, so you know how difficult that is once it's in to keep it straight. So one of the reasons they've never gone that way is because once it's in a tactical environment, it's going to be the devil to keep it placed properly. Whereas with the combi tube, as you know, it doesn't go down into the airway. If it displaces, it's fairly easy to correct. Whereas with the ET tube, if it displaces in a tactical environment, it could be a nightmare trying to get that thing, you know, you'd have to take it out, or even just to withdraw it, you may not have the opportunity. So I think that's one of the reasons why they may never have gone Army-wide with that, but that's just my opinion.
And one other thing to add on what Hank's saying, the other big reason that, you know, they didn't go with the ET tube with the medic is if you look at the way the combi tube is used, blind insertion. You know, you go in, blind insertion, you don't need a laryngoscopic blade, you don't need that light. It goes in there. It's almost foolproof. You know what I mean? One of the other airways that we do have that we're slowly introducing that I know some medics have used or are using is the King LT, which is a variant of the combi tube. Well, instead of, you know, and I know you know this, Jamie, the combi tube having two ports to push in the air with a syringe, you only have one. And it pretty much works the same way as a combi tube. So we've gotten away from the intubation, the ET tube, because one, it's a lot more difficult. Two, you need that blade to push that tongue, you know, or pull the epiglottis up. And three, the combi tube is a lot easier to use. And it's a lot quicker training to train somebody on the combi tube versus training somebody in the ET tube.
Right, and the ET tube is a perishable skill, as I guess all three of us know. And, you know, if you don't do it frequently, you lose it.
Yeah, and it makes perfect sense when you start thinking about, you know, what you've got to do in that situation. You're absolutely right. The wrong time to be worrying about your ET tube placement is when you're, you know, getting somebody out of a bad situation in a fireman's carry, because you know that tube's not going to be in when you put them back down.
Right, wind up doing more harm than good.
Right, right.
And another thing, Jamie, that we've evolved, for example, fluid resuscitation. You know, normal ways of fluid resuscitation, peripheral IVs. You know what we found out? Some of these wounds are destroying the veins that we're going to use peripherally. So one of the things the military is going to to be able to administer that fluid is intraosseous. You know, they're getting big on intraosseous. Yeah, and there's more studies out there. You know, there's more trials. But if we can't get a peripheral IV as a medic, and we need that fluid resuscitation for that wounded soldier before we get into the hospital, we have to have some other route. And one of the routes that we have is intraosseous or IO.
And so, you know, you have that, you can get that definitive line, even if you don't have a good IV port that's point to start, you can get that IO access.
Exactly.
Excellent. Well, I want to wrap up with one question, because this is a question I've got a couple of times by email. If someone has a certification, let's say national registry status, either as an EMTB or EMT paramedic in the field, what is there a way, if they're interested in joining the military, does that translate to help them in that direction of training if that's something they want to do? Or is that something that they really need to start from scratch?
Well, they'd have to start from scratch with the military portion of it, as far as, you know, obviously your basic training and things like that. But what they do at Fort Sam, if you're certified as an EMTB or better, they'll put you through an accelerated portion of that. So, yeah, they do facilitate it a little bit. And they're always looking for people. You know, if somebody comes in with a pre-existing certification, the recruiters love that because, you know, it makes everybody's job easier, especially if that's what they want to do.
Leo, have that been your experience as well? Do you get many people coming into the program that were, got their EMT when they were in high school or just out of high school, and they've joined the military and they've got some training ahead of time? Do you see that very often?
You sometimes see that, not as often as I would like, I guess, but you do sometimes see that where somebody already has the EMTB, they want to come in, they want to be a medic, and yes, they do get an accelerated program. When it comes to AIT or the advanced, I even forgot what AIT stands for, or the AIT or the secondary training or their MOS specific training. Now, I've also seen rarely where somebody comes in and they're National Registered Paramedic and they've received the MOS, very rarely received the MOS as a civilian acquired skill. Saying, you know, I'm trained at this level, and they're current, trained at this level, you know, I feel that, you know, I should have to bypass all the EMTB, and they may get, like, a TC3 or a combat medic skills training to bring them up to the MOS. You know, for example, a buddy of mine, that's how he got his MOS. Being a paramedic, he came in, and they gave him the MOS. Now, it all depends on AMED down at Fort Sam Houston, whether they're going to grant that. But, yeah, it is a possibility. I have seen that also.
Well, guys, I just want to, you know, first off, I want to just thank you for taking the time to share this very unique style of medical care that is certainly akin to the EMS services in so many ways. And my hat's off to you and to all the people you're training. Mark Glencourse sent me a text message here just to say, you just wanted to make sure that he was humbled, to let you know that he's humbled by what you and his own UK forces are doing for the rest of us, and that he just wanted to let you know that you have all of his respect. And I concur with that wholeheartedly because, you know, it's a difficult job, and you're making the world a better place for all of us and also keeping our soldiers alive doing it. And that's a pretty amazing thing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jamie.
So, you know, we're just going to wrap up here, but is there any final thoughts you'd like to say about the Army Medical Program and where you see it going? I'll start with Hank. You know, is there something you'd like to wrap up with as a final thought?
Yeah. My civilian medical career, pre-hospital medical career, my military pre-hospital medical career, basically started at the same time when I went into the National Guard. They sent me to medic school, and at the same time, one of the sergeants in my National Guard unit was a volunteer in a local ambulance company and said, hey, you should get your EMT and come with me over there. So I started them at the same time, and at first, they were as different as night and day. You know, what I was learning in the Army and what I was learning civilian side were completely two different things, and I couldn't believe how far apart the two were. And there were days where I would say, wow, I can't believe the military is doing it this way. And then I'd say, wow, I can't believe the state is so dumb doing it this way. But over the years, they've gone from, as I said earlier, from parallel paths to now crossing over frequently. Different things that we do in the military are identical to civilian, and there's a lot of back and forth exchange that's happening now. And my view of what, my opinion anyway, of what the future might be, is that the two of them are really going to come together, and there'll be very little, if any, difference someday between what an Army medic does and what a civilian medic does, and just using generic terms at that point. But I really see them coming together even closer than they are now.
Leo, how about you? Any final thoughts about the future of Army medicine or the things you'd like to share with the audience out there? Most of them are EMS providers or students in EMS services, about Army medicine.
I do, Jamie. I personally think the EMS, you know, be it military, be it civilian, is going to evolve to great things. You know, we've seen it since the beginning of this war, and we're going to continue to see it. If you think about, you know, when I think about when I joined as a medic, I did it because I wanted to help people out. You know, and I talked to people that are around me, people in the military, people in the civilian, they joined because they really wanted to help people out. You know, us in the EMS world, we're not rich. We don't get rich by being a paramedic. We don't get rich by being, you know, an EMT. But the majority of us, most of us, do it because we want to help out. And let me tell you, you know, I know I've been deployed twice, but I got to give it to people here in the United, in the civilian world in the United States. I got to give it to people that are still over there. Let me tell you, if it wasn't for these people that are dedicated to do what they do, you know, it's great being a part of that team, civilian and military. You know, we do it because we love it. We do it because we want to save lives. We do it because we want to make a future for our children and our children's children. You know, Jamie, you've been the paramedic. I gotta give it to you, man. You know, Hank, everybody. You know, we do it because we love it, and we do it because we want to help out. And if you're out there and you know, EMS world sometimes gets a little, you know, not too good, but just stick in there. You're doing the right thing. You're helping people out, believe it or not. You're in the military, same thing. You know, no matter what your MOS is, we're out there to make the future a better place. You know, and I really, truly believe that.
Well, I want to thank you both again. And also, please convey my thanks to Sergeant Levy, who lined you two up to be on this call. And he's extended an invitation to me to come up there and see some of the toys you all have and look at some of the ways you guys train. And I'm not too far away down in Maryland, so I'm going to try to figure out a time that I can get up there, and maybe I'll get a chance to meet both of you face-to-face.
Oh, great. You would definitely have to. We'll take it to the sim lab.
Great. I'll be able to share it firsthand with the listeners then.
Oh, I'm telling you, it'd be great. Maybe we could do another show like this.
Oh, that would be a lot of fun. I look forward to it. So that's going to wrap up this very special episode of the MedicCast Live from last Thursday night. And I want to extend a special thanks again to Sergeant Leo Mijares and Sergeant Hank Clemens, who were gracious enough to join me, and also to Sergeant Levy, who put this whole thing together, got the instructors available for me, and really helped me put this whole interview together, along with Lieutenant Lydia Cristobal, who I interviewed on the nursing show about Army nursing, and she told me she was an instructor as well at the Army Medic Center, and she put me in touch with Sergeant Levy. So a nice chain of people that I was able to get this whole thing set up for, and this has been a long time coming. As many of you listeners who've been around for a while know, we have been trying to arrange an Army medic from the United States Army to come on the show, and for one reason or another, we've just had those plans fall through. So I'm really was very excited to find out that we could get this rolling this month, and I grabbed the opportunity as soon as it presented itself. We'll have more information. Again, remember, medicast.com/blog for the show notes for this episode. You can check out the links there to Mark Glencourse as well. A special thank you to him for checking in from the 999medic.com blog. He's a UK medic, member of the Chronicles of EMS team. And Mark was available to come on the show tonight as well for a short period of time, but he had a really wonky Skype connection in the hotel that he is staying in, so we had to drop him out of the call, and he wasn't able to get back on. But definitely check out Mark's blog as well. There'll be links in the show notes, as always, and don't forget you can sign up for the newsletter. Get back in touch with me. I'd love to hear from you, your thoughts and comments about this episode. Remember, those emails can go to podmedic@mac.com. You can also leave a comment right over on the blog and share some commentary back and forth in the blog comments right there on the MedicCast blog. Just click on the show notes, find the link for this episode, and then right there you'll see a little talk bubble. Just click on that and it'll take you down to the comments section at the bottom of the page, or you can just scroll down to the bottom of the page and click on the comments link. As always, don't forget you can call in on the voicemail line, 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. That's it for me. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. We're going to wrap up this episode, as I always do, reminding each and every one of you to remember, scene safety, BSI.